I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Heather Menzies joins me now. She's written a new book, Reclaiming the Commons for the Common Good. It's a memoir and a manifesto, and I'll get Ms. Menzies to tell us about what's in the book, how she views the world as it is, and what it could be. I'll get her to tell us what the commons means, as we hear it a lot. I'll ask her how she came to realize the heritage of the commons and how we've lost sight of that. There's politics, too, in this book, and it'll be interesting to get her take on our discourse and what ideas she has that could improve how we connect with one another and how decisions are made about our future. Heather Menzies is an award-winning writer, scholar, and a member of the Order of Canada. She's written 9 books. Visit heathermenzies.ca for more. This book is published by New Society. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Heather Menzies. Ms. Menzies, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I understand you're on Gabriola Island today. Is that correct?
That's correct. I do a launch event tomorrow.
Yeah. So you live there part-time?
Part-time. I have a little cabin where I've done all the major drafts of my books, so at least the last 3 books, if not 4. It's a beautiful place to go to write.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm interested in, because I've never been there, and we hear a lot about it, and I'm sure people listening to us haven't been there. I mean, what does it look like?
It's a great big lump of sandstone, and what's glorious about it is where that sandstone meets the water. The sandstone is really eroded, and so it's got these great flat expanses that are curvature, curvature, curvature. And if you are a writer who's trying to think your way out of status quo ways of thinking, this is the perfect environment, because you lose yourself in these endless beach walks you can do here on the island. And when you come back, sometimes you've got the breakthroughs you're needing in order to write something different.
That's what this book does. It tells us about your life on Gabriola, as well as, I guess, the journey you took back to Scotland. Your Scottish heritage, is that right?
It's a Scottish heritage, yeah. I really knew nothing about how my ancestors had lived. My impulse to go to Scotland and seek out my ancestral roots came out of a general sense of feeling lost and feeling at a dead end as a writer, because I'd been writing about, I had an analysis of the degradation of the social environment, you know, deepening inequalities, the shift to the online world taking us, you know, into such a fast-forward, multitasking, fragmented life. We were disconnecting from ourselves and we were disconnecting from Earth. Well, that degrading social environment was on a collision course with the natural environment and the degradations that are happening in it, and global climate change and all this sort of thing, with excessive overdevelopment associated with this very thing I'd been critiquing, the global digital economy. And I knew what I was against. I was against this unbridled overdevelopment and the how much the human factor and the what the planet needs to sustain itself in a healthy way was marginalized, and the only consideration seemed to be, you know, profits and perhaps at best a few jobs. I knew how I was against that, but I didn't know really how to frame an alternative and how to ground myself in something that I was really for. And it was in that sense of being at a loss that I sought out my ancestral roots. And what I discovered, to my absolute delight but also total surprise, is that my ancestors had lived on the commons in the highlands of Scotland. The commoning is a way of life, and really you need to understand it in a verb form.
Huh.
People living together with the land, that's what the commons and commoning is all about. That persisted in the highlands, particularly in some of the northern areas and the remote glens, really up until the clearances. What I ended up doing was combining a lot of research into what scholars have been able to unearth about the self-organizing, self-governing, and self-informing commons practices. I combined that with walking the land that, in fact, my ancestors had walked, and where they had farmed, and where they'd taken their sheep and their cows and their goats for the summer to pasture. And it was so interesting. The process, an Ojibwe friend of mine as I was embarking on the first of my trips to Scotland, and I said, you know, I'm sort of going to look for my ancestral roots. She said, yeah, right, you're going to welcome your ancestors back. And in a sense, I did. What I did was I opened myself to this way of being in the world, this way of organizing society that was radically different from something that is controlled by the state or controlled by the market. This is all about governance according to the social priorities of community and the ecological priorities of the land. And I think that's what makes it such an exciting find and a timely find, to reclaim the heritage of the commons, reclaim the positive that it has to offer us, is very, very timely because it's a way in which we can ground ourselves in an alternative where accountability, instead of being to the global investment market, accountability comes back to the earth and the land itself. And that's a very hopeful sign because that's our, I think it offers us a way to not just have a vision, but have some practical ways of enacting that vision that will truly address the root causes of climate change. And I think at the root cause, it's the disconnect that has set in with this modern market economy that has become so digitized that it's free-floating in its own orbit, but at the same time sucking out all the life of the planet, but so disconnected from the life of communities in the planet that it can't feel for the tragedy that's going on.
Now, what's it like? Because what you've described for you seems to be a very positive experience. I mean, you saw your life and the world in a different light. You understand it better. You're hopeful. What does that do for you day to day, say? I mean, does it change your life? It must.
Absolutely, yeah. Huge, Joe. One of the big things is that it has shifted my perception so that I, instead of viewing nature, for instance, in that, you know, seeing it as mastery over nature, or even stewardship of nature, which is the kinder, gentler version of it, I no longer even see myself as steward of nature. I see myself as an implicated participant in the habitats of the living world. And that brings me much, much closer to the First Nations way of thinking. So what one of the instant results, Joe, is that First Nations and what they're doing in the Idle No More movement is no longer strange, exotic, or other to me. I can see, basically, the commons heritage is the parallel for non-native people in terms of an alternative mindset and consciousness or way of proceeding to draw on.
So
that's what's given me a sense of hope and optimism.
So why have we lost sight of the ways of your ancestors? Who do we blame, say, for veering off that path?
Well, they always say that history is written by the winners, and mostly people apply that to the context of war, but it's also the case of major shifts of civilization. And with the rise of modernity, we had the first wave of technological change was associated with the agricultural revolution, the second with the industrial revolution, and we're living through the sort of last phase of the third, which is the digital revolution. In the agricultural revolution, you are starting to see a whole new way of thinking around economy, which is, let's maximize how much produce we can pull from the land using agricultural, new techniques of agriculture, so that we can sell that extra produce in the emerging markets of the modern nation state, and also the emerging markets of the modern mercantile empire. And first it was British Empire and then became American. And there were people who were, the propagandists, to put it in an unkind way, but just the the proselytizers of, they called it the improvement movement. And they were the new knowledge elites who relied on written texts and statistical analysis, the new forms of knowledge. And they used those to discredit those people who were still using oral communication as the basis of their knowledge. And they made assumptions. For instance, this famous article about the tragedy of the commons written by Garrett Hardin, mm-hmm. which was published in the 1970s and got a great deal of press, was based on an essay that was written in 1832 by somebody who was very much part of this improvement movement. And he was an amateur mathematician. And he did some statistical analysis, and the big fallacious thing that he did was he assumed that everybody who lived on the commons used utilitarian thinking. Everybody thought of themselves first as individuals, and they wanted to maximize how much they could gain out of life. The truth of the matter, which this guy never bothered to check out, was that people were still steeped in the commoning way of life and the commoning way of thinking, which was that you did everything in shares, you worked things out together, you compromised, you constantly worked out the compromise between individual self-interest and the collective self-interest in sustaining the land and in order to sustain everybody's life. So what this guy ignored was that through the self-governance, the local people in their commoning meetings, and it was the General Assembly kind of thing, which is what the Occupy movement has brought back to life, they would agree on setting limits on the number of sheep and cows that would be sent to the common pasture. They would agree on how often strips of the field that were used for growing grains, how often those would be left to lie fallow so that they would recover their fertility. All of this was part of the self-governance, and that was completely ignored. And the whole notion of common good governance was derided as, oh, that cannot succeed. And so we talk about spin doctoring today. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. That was the spin doctoring of the day.
So you are hopeful, then, that we can go back to this? I mean, you're going up against, as you said, a sort of digital revolution. You're going up against capitalism, really. Do you think those things could be overcome?
Well, what gives me hope is that people are hungry for alternatives. There are more and more people who are saying the status quo is killing us. In terms of the social realm, you're seeing more and more people marginalized, greater inequalities, and then you're seeing the effects of the disconnect in rising levels of depression, isolation, loneliness. Then on the side of the natural environment, look at what we've got, the rising levels of carbon, the rising temperature in the oceans, the ocean currents be going askew, increasing extreme weather, all of this sort of thing. People are saying, we are in a box canyon, we need to look for alternatives. And there is a huge turning in various ways that people are searching out alternatives. And one of the reasons that I call for bridging the divide between global activism and local activism is that at the local level, people can engage in making an actual difference. So you're seeing all this rise of community gardens, and you're seeing people taking action around housing and safe housing and affordable housing, new actions towards reclaiming public health. And it's at the local level that people are able to renew and reapply the commons practices, which are you just get in there and you do things in shares, you rely on leadership from within, and people are regaining the skills and the confidence that we need to reclaim at all kinds of levels. Like we're reclaiming the power of naming what's important. You know, you're hearing constantly that only thing that's important is satisfying stock market, or making sure there's some more jobs, even if they're short-term and bit-part jobs. And people are saying, no, no, we are changing the language here. What is important is engaging people meaningfully and being able to sustain life in a healthy way. And this is how we do it. And so we're seeing the in concrete ways, at a local level, people saying, in this project, here's an example of where we need to be going. And what I'm saying is that we need to pay attention to having the kind of media support we need to get word out, and so people are sharing stories and seeing the commonalities and beginning to scale up local projects like cooperative food depots and cooperative grocery stores and cooperative housing, and sharing all this at a policy level to enlarge what I'm calling the commons sector of the economy. This is a sector where it's being governed according to the ecological needs of land, water, and air, and the social needs of communities. We're enlarging that so that there is less and less of a monopoly being held by the global market economy, and then at the same time identifying the kind of policy that needs to be enacted at a national and international level, for instance, to break the control of these free trade agreements, the CETA being the last example. And it's as people take action at a local level, they find their voice, they gain a sense of their own agency, their agency as individuals, but very much their agency working with others to make a difference. And it's I think one of the reasons that there's been so much despair out there is that people have internalize the sense that there is no alternative, where in fact there is, because we can make it happen. Yeah. That's what gives me hope, if not optimism.
Yeah, well, I guess one of the biggest problems that I see, and you know, I don't take your view of the world and as it is. I mean, that's not you know, where I am, say, in the political spectrum. But one of the things that concerns me, and I think concerns you as well, is the decline in rational argument in our discourse. So how do we overcome that? How would you suggest we overcome? I mean, you talked about climate change a moment ago and sort of the environmental emergencies that we're facing as a planet. There's a lot of debate on those topics, but the debate is, as you well know, words like the science hasn't been settled yet, or that climate change may not exist. I mean, to me, that suggests a lack in sort of rational thinking. So how would you overcome that?
One of the ways is that I am recommending that the what we call a debate gets changed into something more of a dialogue. And that the dialogue be much more inclusive of people bringing the stories of their actual experience, so that instead of it being a debate between experts who have their scientific data versus their scientific data, you've got people bringing, enlarging the model of knowledge on which we're making decisions to include not only the sort of things we associate with expert knowledge, but we also include the knowledge that is the voice of experience and the voice of people relating to habitat, people who are living immersed in wherever they are, be it a neighborhood that has gone downhill or be it out in Fort Chipewyan being affected by the toxic seepage of the tar sands development. And that voice of actual lived experience that is speaking to the realities of how much is being threatened, but also championing what is needed in order to have health. And we need to stint, and that's a word from the commons, we need to set limits on the pace and scale of development all over the place. And so if we move from a debate format where it's sort of like who knows who's in charge of deciding who wins the debate.
Yeah.
We move away from that towards a dialogue about what is actually happening and what are we going to do about it. How are we going to reconcile all competing interests, the interests of global corporations versus the interests of families and animals and fish and trees and bogs and all that kind of thing. We can move that thing forward. I agree with you that we lack, well, I wouldn't say, I don't put so much emphasis on the word rational, but we don't have enough public conversation going on about these things. I'm remembering in CBC back in the 1940s, they had Radio Farm Forum, where it was a combination of kitchen table community discussions and that would be collected, the results of which would be collected, and you'd get consensus that was then broadcast, announced the next week on CBC Radio. And it was a beautiful illustration of the kind of dialogue that enfranchises people as participants in decision-making for the common good. This kind of dialogue that has fallen so silent in our society. And most people have somehow internalized the notion that they have nothing worthwhile to say and their thinking doesn't matter. Well, people need to resist that kind of thinking. They need to break their silence. They need to be involved, become informed, and make that, regenerate that dialogue leading to what are we going to do that's going to make a difference.
Well, one of the interesting things that you talk about in the book is on your visit back to Scotland and understanding that, this fed into your understanding, well, I guess it fed into my understanding of say, the relationship that we have with the First Nations, with Idle No More. In Scotland, you understood the idea of being colonized.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And the colonization happens constantly. When I was speaking at the Vancouver Library, I actually was talking about how people had no time.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I find it helpful to think of it as how much we are colonized right now by digital media. That they it's not that I'm dissing digital media, it's how much they control our time and leave us with no time to think for ourselves, no discretionary time to say, I'm going to go and get involved in this community gardens or whatever, this sort of thing. And when I was in Scotland, yeah, to have steeped myself, immersed myself in this way of being in the world that was discredited, and then I was subjected to this, basically the colonization of the modern rational utilitarian ways of thinking, and I'd never thought of it in those terms. But it was so neat to be able to, you know, encounter concepts like duchess, this sense of inherited responsibility towards your people and the land that they inhabited. Because that is so similar to the sense of inherited responsibility that motivated those five women who started the Idle No More movement. Because it was when Harper brought in that omnibus bill, I think it was the C-45, although it was the other one was just about as bad. But in C-45, that was where it was bringing in changes that was going to, the plan to remove Crown responsibility for caring about up to 90% of the lakes and rivers of this country. And First Nations people had this sense of inherited responsibility, and they said, if the Crown won't be responsible, we've got to step up to the plate. And I can totally relate to that, because I was reacquainted with an understanding of land that is habitat rather than real estate.
Do you think the Idle No More experience, because, I mean, it sort of faded from, say, the daily press, the morning newspapers, the news every night, do you think that's changed anything in terms of the discussions we're having as a nation, as a country, say, with the First Nations people?
I think one of the biggest enduring effects of that, and I really think even though the Isle of No More has been a little quiet, I think it's still very much a force out there. I think one of the things it's done, the gift of it to all of us, is it is reminding us, it has reminded us, that there are alternative ways of thinking about how we organize ourselves, how we organize life on this planet. There is a way that is more according to right relationships, where you think more in terms of relationships with other people, between ourselves and the land, versus this radical individualism that is all about control for the sake of production and mastery and so on and so forth. So it's very inspiring, I think, for people to have had this Isle No More movement bringing the language. I mean, I was in Ottawa when Chief Theresa Spence was having was conducting this hunger strike on Victoria Island, and I would regularly go bringing food and firewood. And I was there when this guy who described himself as a seventh generation of Tecumseh showed up and said to Chief Theresa Spence, "You speak from the heart of the earth." And that language is what's inspiring people.
Yeah. This is such a fascinating book. There's so much more to talk to you about. I've enjoyed talking to you today. Congratulations on this book. Good luck with it, Heather.
Thank you, Drew.
HeatherMenzies.ca is a website for more. The book is called Reclaiming the Commons for the Common Good. It's published by New Society. Heather Menzies joined me on the line from Gabriola Island in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.